We are talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and we're talking today to Desiree Mays, International Opera Lecturer and Storyteller. International Opera Lecturer and Storyteller, and author of the new book Opera Unveiled, now in its 15th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
And we're talking today about the opera Oscar, which is a great highlight of this season at the Santa Fe Opera. It is, of course, about Oscar Wilde, who is the author of one of my favorite mottos, namely, I can resist anything except temptation.
Yes. He was very well known for these wonderful aphorisms. Oscar Wilde was an Irishman, first and foremost.
Tell us his whole name.
You want his whole name? Okay.
With your beautiful Desiree Irish accent.
His whole name was Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wills Wilde was Irish. He's not an Englishman. Some people here do seem to be under that misconception. They also think George Bernard Shaw was English. They both had their careers in London, of course, in England. But they are both Irish, I'm very proud to announce. He was born in Dublin in 1854, first went to Trinity College and then to Oxford. So this amazing, amazing human being who really reached the heights in terms of a literary career. He was a magnificent playwright. He wrote a book, the famous Life of Dorian Gray.
The Picture of Dorian Gray.
He wrote children's stories. That's how I first came to Oscar Wilde as a child in Ireland. These were the wonderful children's stories we listened to, The Little Prince, The Fisherman's Soul, The Selfish Giant. And they are stories one should still go back to and read, preferably before you see the opera. The opera doesn't deal with the glory of Oscar Wilde, which is one of the interesting questions. You know, how do you take a life like Oscar Wilde's and where do you pick it up? So the early part of his life was very successful. He was in Oxford. He was very outgoing, very gregarious. He fell in love with a couple of appropriate young women but didn't marry them. But he was fascinated with the whole decadent movement. He was in love with the beauty for its own sake, art for its own sake. And he was showing leanings of being gay, homosexual, even in college. But in spite of this, in 1884, I think it was, he got married to Constance, who was the daughter of a barrister. And it was a very happy marriage for about 6-7 years. They had two sons whom he adored. He loved these two boys, Vivian and Cyril. But then he met Lord Alfred Douglas, who we all know as Bosie, who is the son of the Marquess of Queensberry. Bosie was at Oxford. He was a very beautiful boy, and Oscar offered to coach him in poetry. And they fell in love, and they had this amazing love-hate relationship. And it was Bosie who introduced Oscar to the world of London's underworld of male prostitution, which was, of course, the beginning of the downfall. But in the meantime, he had the most amazing career. He came to America. He was here for a year in 1882, and he did a lecture tour in outrageous clothes. I mean, he was very flamboyant, but everyone seemed to love him. A great example is when he went to Leadville, up the road here.
Leadville, Colorado,
to the mining town.
I love that.
The Tabor Opera House, which is still there. And he went and he gave a talk. And you wondered, you know, how would he get on with these miners? They were mining for silver. So he talked to them about another silversmith, Benvenuto Cellini. And the miners were saying, why didn't you bring him with you? You know, he was a hit.
He was a Renaissance
sculptor, of course, in silver. Beautiful work. So at the end of the talk, they invited him to dinner and they brought him down the mine. They were opening a special shaft to be called the Oscar. So he goes down in this bucket, which must have been very hard given the velvet clothes that he wore. And he got to the bottom. He said, we had a marvelous dinner. The first course was whiskey. The second was whiskey. And the third course was whiskey. So you can see how much how much of a hit he was. He was very outgoing. He was very generous. He came from a wonderful family. His father had been an eye and ear a doctor, very famous, and his mother, who had fought for the Irish nationalist cause, she was quite a character. These were two highly respected people in Ireland, and when the father died, the mother moved to London, and they had these salons, and they were the parties where everybody wanted to be seen, and Oscar would always be the center of attention. He fell in love with theater, and for instance, when Sarah Bernhardt arrived on English shores, he was there to greet her at the gangplank and threw lilies at her feet. And then the terribly sad irony that years later, Sarah Bernhardt would play Salome, his play, and the first night was in Paris when he was in prison in Reading Jail. So the tragedy. So there was all this magnificent career that Oscar Wilde had before we even get to the opera. And when we come to the opera is by Theodore Morrison, who is a wonderful man from back east. He's known for, originally he was involved with organ work and chorale work. He's written a wonderful choral symphony, Art and Resurrection, and a number of songs based on beautiful poetry of Walt Whitman, Joyce, people like that. But when I came to write my chapter for Opera Unveiled, you know, this is a world premiere. There's a lot of buzz everywhere about this opera. An opera and Oscar Wilde, isn't that a sort of a edgy subject to be taking on? It is.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're just on the verge of legalizing gay marriage.
That's
everywhere,
right.
So it's a beautiful year to be doing that.
It is. I can't imagine that when they started working on this a few years ago, they would have any idea, actually, that this whole question of gay marriage and human rights, equal rights in terms of the whole gay movement would be coming to a head. But you'll hear about that. So today I'm really happy to be able to play some of the interviews with the creation team, starting with Theodore Morrison, who is the composer. And when he was asked about how did this whole thing come to life in the first place, I think he describes it very well. So maybe we could hear that in his own words.
I had gone to London to hear David Daniels sing the British premiere of my song cycle on poems by James Joyce. And it was a fantastic performance. Martin Katz played the piano, and he's one of the greatest. And then I went backstage afterwards to greet David, and a tall gentleman came in and introduced himself as John Cox. I didn't know John, but he said he was an opera director, and I should have known that, but I didn't, not being that associated with the opera world at that time. And then John said, "Have you ever written an opera?" He told me he had really loved the song cycle, and I said, "No, but I would certainly like to write one for David." And he said, "Well, here's my card. If you're interested in discussing this more, please be in touch." So after I determined that this is something I really wanted to do, I called David, who was living in Washington at the time, and said, "David, John Cox and I have been talking about maybe writing an opera for you. Would you be interested?" And he said, "Well, let's talk." So I flew down to Washington. David and I had a chat, and we tried to figure out what would be a good subject for an opera for him. He's a countertenor, and he sings in the mezzo-soprano range. It so happens that Max Beerbohm, one of Oscar's famous friends, said that Oscar had a mezzo voice, a very expressive mezzo voice. And I thought, oh, my golly, that's just the right thing for David. And the subject is something that David was very excited about. Well, Walt Whitman begins the opera and introduces Oscar Wilde and the story. He's something like a Shakespearean chorus. At the end of the prologue, Oscar says, "What lies before you is my past." He's infamous by then from having been accused of gross indecency, which simply meant homosexual love at that time. And then the scene jumps to the London streets, where Oscar is an ostracized man from society, looking for rooms in hotels, can't find a hotel that will take him. And he winds up in the home of Ada Leverson, who was one of the great literary figures of the time. And so she invites Oscar to wait out his time for the trial in her nursery apartment, because her child, Violet, was in the country with her husband. We also have taken Lord Alfred Douglas, who's called Bosie, who was Oscar Wilde's great love, and we brought him into the story as a dancer, so that he never speaks. He's always a figment of Oscar's imagination, and he dances in very different costumes for different purposes, but underneath these costumes is Bosie Douglas. And Oscar Wilde said, if you give a man a mask, he will tell you the truth. So there will be a series of masks that work along with this. And near the end of the act, Ada is waiting for news of the results of the trial. Frank Harris arrives, and he's in a furious diatribe. He tells what had happened in the trial. The conviction, the hanging judge who gave the maximum sentence, and so forth. What we do on the stage is have the nursery explode into the Old Bailey during Frank's diatribe. And there is a black farce in which the judge arrives costumed as a clown. The jury arrive one by one, scampering on the stage as costumed as puppets, toys, dolls, and so forth. The sort of thing one would find in a nursery. And then Oscar Wilde is brought in a solemn procession, and he seems to be the only sane person in the room. Oscar Wilde is a great man. We present him not as a victim. We present him as a hero. Oscar is my very first opera. Hope it's not my last. What I have learned about making an opera is not only what I've learned from David and John, it's also what I've learned from the Santa Fe Opera and from the marvelous administration here and how devoted they are to getting the highest artistic product they can. And so they have spared no means to make this an important event. And I feel humbled, honored, and thrilled that this is happening.
And we've just been listening to Theodore Morrison, the composer of the opera Oscar, which premieres this year, the world premieres this summer at the Santa Fe Opera.
Yes, it is, the 27th of July, yes.
And it's interesting because, I mean, we've talked so many times over the years about specific operas, the lead role is written for a certain singer, and that's what this is.
Yes, the question will come up, has come up, you know, why is Oscar Wilde sung by a countertenor? It's still a voice that people are getting used to, I think, and I can talk a little bit about what that voice is. And I'm going to actually play you David Daniels singing so we can experience it firsthand. I think the reasoning is very interesting. The main reason that this opera is sung by a countertenor is that David Daniels, one of the world's greatest countertenors, has been singing a lot of Baroque repertoire, which is typically what a countertenor sings, and wanted an opera that would make a social statement. And when this came up, he said, yes, this is exactly what I want to do. So given that, and given the fact that he had actually been a student of Theodore Morrison's way back when he was a baritone, but he wasn't having much success as a regular singer. And he used to go and party at night and sing all the soprano roles at parties until finally his coach said, well, why don't you take this seriously? And he did, and the rest is history. This man has the most extraordinarily beautiful sound, but he's a countertenor. So what is a countertenor? It's hard to get a definitive answer to that question because many people will say this is a falsettist, someone who is singing beyond, higher than the full voice. The full voice in a very high tenor voice is what we call a Helden tenor, you find in a lot of Wagner operas. But they're singing full voice in the male voice. This has gone that step higher, and it sounds like an alto, a mezzo-soprano, even a soprano voice. There is, it's an incredibly beautiful sound. It was around a lot at the time of the Baroque, at the time of Handel, and then sort of dropped out of the repertoire. And it wasn't until Benjamin Britten brought that back in some of his operas. There's a quote here from a great vocal coach, David Jones, who says, In my experience, the countertenor is basically a singer who has developed the falsetto with such strength that it has similar power and resonance to a full voice sound. Often these singers possess a lower male voice, a baritone or bass is their natural voice, which is amazing. You'd expect it to be a tenor. It's not necessarily a tenor. And that is actually is greater because this singer often possesses the ability to hold back tremendous amounts of breath pressure with the body, which allows the falsetto to develop great strength and beauty of tone along with an extraordinary agility. And this agility makes it possible to sing these florid phrases demanded in the repertoire for the countertenor.
Do any of the countertenors train in both ranges? It would be so interesting to hear a countertenor then boom into his baritone and then go back again.
According to this teacher, no, because one does not complement the other. If the countertenor has to come down at the lower end of the countertenor range, yes, then it has to be that switch into the full voice, and that has to be very carefully done. And it's not something, you know, once you make the decision to make the switch. They say, the coaches, that it's both it's a physical and a psychological switch. It's a major switch to do this. And David Daniels has been at the forefront, certainly in America, of this trend, which is now becoming very popular. So I was fortunate. The Santa Fe Opera has up on its website some of these interviews with the production team, but I excerpted a little bit for your show, Mary Charlotte. So I thought it'd be nice to hear from David Daniels himself as to why he is taking on this role.
Excellent. Let's hear.
When Theo came to me to ask, you know, subject matter, my comment to him was not so much about a historical figure, but something that had an edge to it, something that had an emotion that was contemporary, that was now, something that could make a difference now. And could be understood now in 2013, and certainly I feel like Oscar Wilde is perfect for that. And it was Theo and John Cox who actually said Oscar Wilde at the same time, I believe. So I would love to take credit for it, but I loved the idea, but it was not my idea. Just the fear of what he was put through certainly resonates hugely today. And that is where I got the most excited about this story. It's important that I don't play Oscar Wilde as an impersonator trying to be Oscar Wilde with the cigarette and with mannerisms and, you know, Stephen Fry coming to the opera stage. I think that's really important that it be told as a human story and as an emotional story and not about trying to be Rich Little doing an impersonation, trying to get the language or the accent perfect. Because then it becomes about that and it doesn't become about the emotional content. Personal things in my life happen where I've seen this kind of persecution happen, and it still happens a lot. And I'm hoping that this touches people, as any artistic anything, that it makes people think and it makes people leave the theater changed.
And that was David Daniels talking about playing the role of Oscar Wilde. This is really a groundbreaking moment, isn't it?
It really is, and it's really exciting to be able to hear from the singer for whom the role has been written.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very rare, and he's a very responsible artist, I think, as you can hear in this. He's thought this through carefully. It'll be fascinating to see how he shapes this role in rehearsal. Well, I thought having heard that sort of deep voice, his speaking voice, it might be interesting to hear him sing, remembering that at this point, we don't have music for the opera because until July 27th, we won't know how
that's
it sounds.
That's right. And we're recording before that.
That's right. Yeah. And it's always a challenge for me to write this chapter, sight unseen. So I feel really blessed to be able to talk to the composer, directors, and the singer. So the piece I do have for you to listen to from David Daniels, the countertenor, is a piece that was actually written for him by Theodore Morrison. It's called Chamber Music, a song cycle based on James Joyce songs. So listen to this. Listen to the beauty of the tone. It is a slightly different sound, but it's one that you should probably hear a lot of before you go to the opera to be familiar with it. But this is David Daniels singing Theodore Morrison.
And that is David Daniels singing in his beautiful countertenor voice a piece of music by Theodore Morrison, who wrote the opera Oscar.
And who wrote the song cycle for David as well. So
right.
They go back, you know, and it's lovely to see that collaboration. The third partner, really the leading partner in this too, is John Cox, who's a very well-known London opera director and theater director.
And he did the libretto.
He wrote the libretto for this, very proudly. And I talked with him also. Email is incredible. I can email these people all around the world. And they are so generous, Mary Charlotte, both the composer and the librettist, in getting back to me and talking about this. He said that they had gone to great lengths, the production team, to actually use the quotes of Wilde himself, to quote from letters. And there's two sections in the opera that are direct quotes from De Profundis, which is the great essay he wrote when he was in prison, and the Ballad of Reading Jail, the last thing he wrote, which is about prison conditions in Victorian prison system, which were horrendous. So those are directly in the libretto, and they said the connective tissue is ours. That's what John Cox said. So in order to link the sections together, they may not be in exact chronological order, but they really are the words of Wilde.
It takes a lot of art to use original sources and weave them seamlessly into a work of theater.
Yeah, and since it's being done by someone of the caliber of John Cox who truly understands theater, because Theo Morrison this is his first opera. He's not so conversant with the theater demands.
Yeah.
And working with Cox, he said, was amazing. You know, he'd send him reams of stuff that John Cox would throw out. And then they went through this process for quite a long time. But I think they've come up with something really special. I've read the libretto, but of course haven't heard the music yet, which is why we're playing other pieces of David Daniels. Well, as we talked about, the story picks up. They decided that they would start this opera. The story begins on the night before the trial and how Oscar is cast out from every hotel in London. I mean, this is so horrendous because this man entertained royally all of his friends at these incredible hotels and restaurants. But the Marquis Thomas of Queensbury, who was Bowes's father, hated him so much and was determined to bring him down that he had his thugs go to the hotels and threaten the managers if they put Oscar Wilde up that there would be trouble in the hotel. I mean, it was that bad. The whole trial was a farce. So he finds refuge, as it were, in the home of Ada Leveson, and it's there they hear the news that he has been condemned, literally condemned, to 2 years hard labor. And hard labor in those days was horrendous. It was life-threatening. It's amazing he survived. Even the fellow prisoners had said that, you know, this was a man who lived a soft life. You know, he lived at the Ritz and all those great hotels. He wasn't used to physical labor. And the torture of that was that he was in solitary most of the time, not able to speak, forbidden to write or to read or see papers. And they put, and you'll see this in the opera, they bring a crank in, which apparently is what they did, this stupid crank that they would have to turn thousands and thousands of times a day. That was physically exhausting. That or a treadmill. They apparently decided against.
So it wasn't even productive labor.
No, it was just torture. They decided against using a treadmill in the opera because David didn't think he could sing and walk the treadmill. So, but you'll see the crank, and in the score there's a ghastly sound of the crank as it's turning. It's the sound of a ratchet turning. It's one of those really bone-chilling moments, the horror of what happened. So he, in the first act then is about the lead in to the prison, and it ends where he has decided he is not going to jump bail and go to France, where he could have gone and been a free man. Throughout the first act, Bowes is present. Bowes is in this man's heart and soul. He never leaves him. So the choice of making Bowes a dancer, not a singer, I think is a very beautiful choice.
Said Desiree the Dancer. Well,
and we have, I was just looking online, you can do this too, a dancer called Reed Luplau, who is from Australia with an incredible career behind him, who is coming to be the dancer of Bowes. So he materializes in many, many times throughout this opera, sometimes wearing masks and sometimes not. But it shows the anguish in Wilde's heart. And then the whole second act is in the prison. And you see the harshness, the way he was treated. It was barbaric. The prison system was barbaric. And it all but killed him. And as time went on, he began, there's a shift halfway through the second act where he begins to stop focusing on himself and what's happening to him. And he sees the suffering of his fellow prisoners. At one point, he complains to the warden, not complains, but he says, how is it that a 10-year-old boy has been imprisoned with us for stealing a rabbit? The child had stolen a rabbit because to feed his family, and here he was in this gross, gross prison. They were there the night of a hanging, and that's in the opera where suddenly you're taken out of Wilde's world into the world of the prison and the anguish that's going on and the barbarity of it all and how his heart changes while he's in there, and he determines that when he comes out, he will fight for justice in the prison system, and did in the Ballad of Reading Jail, which is in the libretto.
Do we anywhere in the opera see the wild, witty, and wonderful salons of London?
No, none of that is in this. And that's why I think it's important to have a sense and maybe go and read some Wilde before you go to the opera. Get a sense of who this man was. The importance of being earnest, of course, was his great play. This man had 5 plays running, hit shows in the West End, which is equivalent to Broadway, when his trial came up. And the whole trial was a setup. It really was. But he was condemned. So for the 2 years he does, he goes through the horror of the prison, and the opera did not, the production team, the creative team, did not want to end on a really sad down note. So there's this wonderful prologue and epilogue with Walt Whitman. Now, why Walt Whitman? You know, the question everyone will ask. It turns out that Oscar Wilde met Walt Whitman when he did that American tour. He went to Camden, New Jersey, and the two men met, and apparently they really hit it off, and he had great respect for Whitman. So Whitman is in the land of the immortals at the beginning of the opera, and he is welcoming Oscar Wilde to their ranks. And at the end, this again is reenacted, how Oscar Wilde takes his place among the immortals as a great creative genius. genius and welcomed by Walt Whitman, who acts as sort of a commentator. Some of his poetry is in this piece too. It's a very beautiful idea, and it's very novel, it's very timely, and I think it will be extraordinarily effective for an audience sitting out there.
We're talking to Desiree Mays about the opera Oscar. It's part of the Santa Fe Opera. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. And we're back with Desiree Mays talking about Oscar. It's the opera about Oscar Wilde being performed this year at the Santa Fe Opera. And so you have a little clip that we're going to hear now.
Yeah, there's one further clip from this is from the director. John Cox was not able to direct this piece, which would have been the ideal thing. But instead, it's Kevin Newbery, who's been here a number of times. He's a young director, and he's very committed to this piece. He seems to take on social issues or biblical ones, because before he comes to Santa Fe this summer, he's going to direct Mary Magdalene in San Francisco. And the thesis of that opera is that she was the bride of Christ, and using all the Gnostic Gospels and the material that's now come out, that's an edgy subject too. So he'll come from that to Oscar. So let's hear a little of his.
Well, they're both, really about hypocrisy, yes, surrounding sexuality.
Maybe not so different. Exactly. Yeah. And perception of other people. I think a big part of this opera that the creative team wants us to get is that we have all at some time in our lives been in situations of prejudice. We've been isolated or outcast for whatever reason. Even if you walk into a room and people cut you dead, that's a bad feeling. It's those feelings that they are reaching here and saying that, you know, there is us story, but we too have experienced this sort of pain and empathy in an effort to make for human understanding of these issues that are still with us. So let's hear what Kevin Newbery, the director, has to say about that.
Oscar Wilde is such an important character to study because not only was he a great writer and a kind of titan figure of late, 19th century and, of course, carrying on to the 20th century after his death, but he really has a lot to teach us about compassion and humanity. People don't realize that he spent 2 years in prison, hard labor, solitary confinement, the complete dehumanization of a human being that was the hallmark of Victorian prisons. Those Victorian prisons were no joke. And of course, he went to jail for one reason and one reason only, and that was for being gay. And Oscar famously said, "There is no prison door into which love cannot force an entrance." And the piece really is about love and compassion and how we treat other human beings in the world. And if the audience takes anything away from Oscar's story, it's what he gave up for love and for his sexuality and for his beliefs. It's interesting to me to look at what Oscar actually learned during those 2 years of hard labor and solitary confinement in a Victorian prison. And a lot of the text in the opera comes from his own work, including The Ballad of Reading Gaol, about what he saw in prison, what he witnessed. What does Oscar learn from these other prisoners? What does he learn from his friends that stood by him? When he came out of prison, Oscar Wilde was completely penniless. He had no friends, and he died in complete isolation. He was ostracized. After being the toast of the town, he had plays all over the West End. His books were all bestsellers. He was the number one invitee to every single party in London. And then once everyone found out he was gay, well, they knew he was gay. Once he was convicted of it, everybody turned their backs on him, except for a few people. So for me, the piece is really about compassion and love in the face of adversity, and it's a basic treatise on human rights. What does it mean how do we treat other people in the world? That sounds ridiculous, but for me, it really is this amazing treatise on human rights. What is it that is happening in the world today, and how are we treating each other, and what can we learn from Oscar Wilde? Santa Fe Opera is not afraid to take risks, and that's a dream as a director, to do a piece like Oscar and to put the company's name and weight behind this very beautiful story, this very edgy story, is all that I could possibly ask for as a director.
And that is something from the director, Kevin Newbery, who's directing the Oscar Wilde Opera at the Santa Fe Opera. Now, Desiree Mays, you are the author of Opera Unveiled. You put out this book every year. It's in its 15th year.
Right.
Congratulations. And you actually, this chapter is a little different from all the other ones in the book.
It is. When I have to work on a premiere, a new opera, clearly I have very little information and no recording DVDs to work with. But I do have real live breathing composers, directors, and librettists. So typically I will contact them, and always, without exception, I'm always amazed. I send off an email and I get lengthy answers back, and we talk to and fro, and then I put their words into my book. In this case, Theo and John Cox treat this opera as their infant, and you don't mess with the parents of a newborn. Every word was sacred, and they really wanted their point of view to be presented. And this is something I've never done in the book before, because I usually do that. I mean, I wouldn't presume to ask them to take the time to do it. So the eventual outcome was that I would tell in my chapter the life of Oscar Wilde up to the point where the opera begins, and then the rest of the chapter is theirs. So how often do you actually hear firsthand from a composer before a premiere about what their intent is and what the opera? I mean, I can't ask Mozart to do that for me. But I was able to do that with Theo Morrison. So that's something that's really been rather special with this particular book, that I've been able to include the composer's words on this new opera that was written with John Cox as well. They describe the characters and the story and why they do this in the first place. And I think we have a good sense of that from these interviews. There's a responsibility and a seriousness about the approach these three men are taking to this piece that I think is very praiseworthy.
So let's finish telling the story. Basically, the whole story takes place during the period where Oscar Wilde is in jail.
Yes, it's 1895. The first act is leading up to the sentencing, and then the second is the prison years. And these various incidents happen. At one point, he's sitting in the chapel, for instance, and the men are singing loudly some Church of England hymn, because it's the only time they're allowed to use their voices. But Oscar is sitting, and the chaplain notices this, and he's ordered to stand, and the governor comes over and insists that he stand. And he's really too weak. He tries to stand, fall, hits his head, and the governor accuses him of just pretending. But the doctor came over and said, no, he needs to go to the infirmary. So you see that sort of barbarity. The other prisoners take his side. They really are sympathetic to him, even though they cannot talk to him. He's in solitary most of the time. And there's a brutal, putting down of the prisoners who try to support Oscar at this point. So in the infirmary, there's suddenly a wonderful lighthearted scene, which I'm not going to give away, but he's in the infirmary, and there's now a warder who is sympathetic to him and who wants to know about writers. So they get in this dialogue of who do you think of Watsi, so and so and so and so. And Oscar is giving his professional opinion to this warder. And this leads into an absolutely wonderful little moment of music hall parody that provides a wonderful lift in this very serious piece. But that all then goes downhill, because the following day is to be the execution of this man. Then towards the end of the opera, Ada comes to visit him, and she assures him that he will go down in history, that he is a legend. And they start making plans for what he will do when he leaves. What he had hoped to do was to go to the Jesuits and be there and just gather himself together to recover for some time after this imprisonment ended. But actually, the Jesuits turned him down, which I think is terrible. He was not accepted in that one place. The opera doesn't cover this. The last scene in the opera of the prison is where Ada comes to visit him, and he again sees Bosie, but takes a very tender farewell of Bosie as Bosie dances and he sings, until Bosie then fades away and Oscar ascends to the land of the immortals. In real life, when he came out of prison, he went to France. France did not have these laws. He could go there, but he was outcast and he was broken. He had planned to write, but the only thing he wrote after he left prison was the Ballad of Reading Gaol. He and Bosie did get together briefly. Bosie had been, many ways the cause of his downfall. Bosie wanted revenge against his father. He hoped his father would be found guilty in the libel trial, and was not. It was Oscar who went down. So they got together for a little while, but neither of them had funds. The Marquess of Queensberry cut his son off from all money, and Constance Wilde, who had gone to Europe with the two boys.
His wife,
yeah, and changed her name to Constance Holland. The boys became Holland in order to have some anonymity. She had met with Oscar once in prison and asked for a divorce, though she never stopped loving him, apparently. And she agreed to give him an allowance. He'd have something to live on when he came out of prison, unless he got back together with Bosie. And they got back together for a little while, and both the Marquess and Constance said, that's it, we're not giving you any more support. And they literally drifted apart. And from at that point on, he was virtually on his own. There were some friends who were faithful to the very end. Frank Harris, who's in the opera, Robbie Ross, who had been a friend since Oxford. There were friends with him, but typically when he walked the streets of Paris, people saw him, they would cross the street. It was so cruel what happened in the end. And that fall in the prison had done some damage to, I think, his inner ear, and it was that that flared up again. So about 3 years after he was released from prison, he died. But the opera did not want to dwell on that, the sadness of that ending. So they bring it right back up to the land of the immortals, where he is praised and recognized as one of the immortal writers. I mean, that's what he is.
It's side by stunning. Side with Walt Whitman.
Side by side with Walt Whitman, yeah. Who was also gay, of course.
Right, although not persecuted the way Oscar
no,
Wilde
no,
was.
No, nothing like. There was, those laws all changed. Oscar said that he would not flee before the trial, that he would take a stand for the love that dare not speak its name.
Right.
I mean, that line has come down to us today. That's what it is. But now its name is being spoken, and it's wonderful how things are changing in that. But at that time, it was against the law, and he paid a terrible price.
And you know, all the rest of us did, too, all the work that he would have done had he not gone to prison, had he lived a long life. So many more novels and plays and so much more inspiration to the people who came after him.
Yep. Salome is an example. It was written that was, as I said, produced in Paris while he was in prison. It was written in French, actually. And there's a lovely little story about Salome. He's writing the story of Herod and Salome and John the Baptist, and he's listening to music in a little street cafe in Paris, and the musicians are playing, and he's seeking inspiration. So he goes down to the musicians and he says to them, play something, music that represents the beheading of a man, of John the Baptist. And they change the music and he writes the piece. You know, it's a lovely little story. And it was actually Bosie who made that translation of Salome from French into English. And then Richard Strauss's opera Salome is based word for word on that play. So he's had tremendous impact, I think, on the literary world, and the plays are still done in England and Ireland. They play a lot. He was a wonderful human being, but it brings up that question of the artist and the man that I keep running into with opera composers a lot. And I think the work has to be kept separate. Though I was just reading on the children's stories, they are all very bittersweet, his children's stories, of impossible loves, of a young fisherman who wants to be with a mermaid. It's an impossible love. It's a forbidden love. And this was written before his homosexuality had been expressed. But that's really what it's about, a forbidden love that's a very beautiful. He always said it was beautiful and pure, and yet forbidden, and he paid the price. So,
Desiree Mays, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
Now, before we go, there's a couple of things coming up. There's a symposium around the time of the opening of this opera.
Yes, the Education Department of the Santa Fe Opera are putting together a symposium called Oscar Wilde, Celebrity or Notoriety. And this is going to be at July 25th to 27th at the Santa Fe Women's Club. That's the old Santa Fe Trail, I think. And what is truly exciting about this, Mary Charlotte, is that on the 25th, the keynote address will be given by Merlin Holland. That's Oscar Wilde's grandson. He was eight, I think, when he last saw his father, and they were taken to France. He was 14 when his father died, and his mother died also at that time. She died of some spinal injury, so he had no immediate family, and he didn't know the true story of his grandfather until he was 15. Now he has written a book about the man, and he will be here to give the opening address. Merlin Holland, who is the grandson of Oscar Wilde. On the 26th, then, there are a number of papers about Oscar Wilde and Salome, the role of celebrity. And then on the Saturday, I think this is open to everyone, there's a panel discussion. The opera's been doing this every year now. It is so exciting. On the morning of a first night, you can hear the librettist, the composer, and the director talk about the piece. And it's usually absolutely riveting, you know, what their hopes and dreams and aspirations are before the first night. Now, to find out about this, there is a cost if you do the whole symposium, and maybe that would be the way to go. The phone number to call at the opera then to sign up for the symposium is 505-946-2417. Or just ask for the Oscar Wilde symposium and you'll be headed to the right department. But that should be really interesting. And I'm sure the opera is doing this. It'll be exciting.
Desiree, once again, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We actually have a little bit of time for one more piece of music. What is it?
Good. Let's hear again from David Daniels singing the famous, everybody will recognize this, Che farò senza from Orpheus and Eurydice. And this is by Gluck. And this is going all the way back, of course, to the early repertoire. But again, it is David Daniels who will be singing our Oscar in the premiere performances.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654, and the local number is 505-986-5900.